The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Thousands of police officers and firefighters in cities like Chicago and Baltimore could soon be out of work as mandates take effect that require them to report their vaccination status or submit to regular testing. In fact, unvaccinated workers across America are facing possible job cuts as a growing number of states, cities, and private companies enforce vaccine mandates.
We're having inventories pulling down to lower and lower levels. And it's not just in the U.S., but it's across everything we can observe in the world of inventories. It is a very tough entry to winter. The worst case scenario for Europe, and we've had like a half a dozen of these in the last 30 years, Europe will run out of natural gas. And God knows what the price means, because it means you've got to hit a price that really rations consumption to get the market even. So yeah. Double or triple today's prices is well within the realm of reality.
Energy prices are very visible. We know that they're rising, particularly with the crisis in Europe. But shelter prices are the things that are actually making CPI stick around and stay more elevated. And the reason that happens is we saw a 21% rise in national home prices, and that actually leads shelter prices in the CPI component by about a year. So we're seeing a firming of those shelter prices, and that makes up about a third of the CPI component.
Winter is coming.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Rising gasoline prices, rising inflation, border crisis, and supply chain bottlenecks. Despite all that bad news, the market seems to like all the money that is coming into the stock market. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplav, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me at the top of the hour will be Gina Martin Adams, Bloomberg's head equity strategist, as we look as the markets begin to rotate with financials and energy leading. However, there are some impediments down the road. Oil could be one of them. And speaking of oil, later on in the program, Dan Steffens will join me from Energy Prospectus as we take a look at America's approaching energy crisis as policy is creating shortages leading to higher prices. Later on, Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But before we do that, let's take a look at what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
The rally in U.S. stocks continued this week off of another week of strong earnings results as new highs were reached for the Dow Industrial Average and the S&P 500 at one point this week. 23% of the companies in the S&P 500 have reported actual results, pushing the blended earnings growth rate for those companies plus the estimates for those to come up from 30% last week to 32.7% Friday, according to FactSet. FactSet also said at this time, earnings are expected to grow 20% in the fourth quarter, with a pace of growth above 40% for the full year. Stocks did very well last week after the CPI and PPI prints were where the reaction in the bond market was unimpressed at the rate of growth. This week, yields continued to climb higher, with the 10-year Treasury finishing the week at 1.65%, up 8 basis points from last week. Despite the increase in rates, so far this month, the tech sector has done well, up 6% for the month thus far, but the best two performing sectors have been the S&P 500 energy sector and the S&P financial sector, up 11.25% and 8.2% respectively. Now, let's turn to some of the economic reports this week. Total industrial production in the U.S. decreased in September 1.3% due to Hurricane Ida and semiconductor shortages. Housing starts declined 1.6% in September, but were up 7.4% over last year due to labor shortages, high prices, and supply constraints. While existing home sales actually increased 7% for the month, but 2.3% from a year ago. But the trends continued there with high prices and tight inventories. Looking at some of the preliminary regional manufacturing data, we got the Philadelphia Fed Index, which dropped in October to 23.8. from 30.7. And the IHS market manufacturing PMI decreased to 59.2 in October from 60.7, still elevated. The Fed's beige book for October highlighted moderate growth, but that the pace slowed due to supply chain disruptions, labor shortages, and uncertainty surrounding COVID-19's Delta variant. Despite a slight drop in some of the manufacturing data we are getting, the Fed said manufacturing has been robust in many parts of the country, with growth in non-manufacturing growing at a much more moderate pace. Loan demand was flat to modest in the period while consumer spending had grown. They reported that demand for workers is high, but growth has been dampened by a shortage of workers. And finally, looking at prices, the districts reported significantly elevated prices fueled by rising demand for goods and raw materials. They specified that the price pressure has been arising from increased transportation and labor constraints, as well as commodity shortages. Same bad channel, same bad time, as it's the same repeated story we're hearing elsewhere in our research and from company reports. Now let's turn to those company reports. Let's look at the earnings this week and highlight a couple of the special cases. Johnson & Johnson beat earnings but fell short of revenue expectations. Still, the company reported strong performance overall with operational sales growth of 13.8%. One overhang on the company has been the talc powder-related claims. The company set up a $2 billion trust to help resolve those claims, which should help the stock get out from under that cloud. And while that issue continues to hurt baby care products, sales in their other over-the-counter drugs helped push growth up 5.7% for total consumer health sales. While the company had manufacturing problems related to its vaccine earlier in the year and has only generated about $503 million in sales in the third quarter, it expects to deliver on its projection of $2.5 billion in sales for the full year and helped by last week's FDA approval for its booster in people over the age of 18. As fewer people elect to postpone surgeries as a result of COVID last year, Johnson & Johnson has seen a pickup in medical device growth. Johnson & Johnson closed up 2.3% after announcing earnings, so a nice reaction by investors there. Netflix reported a big earnings surprise, but that was largely baked into the stock price's rise since the summer. Due to the excitement building around its latest hit, Squid Game, their biggest TV show ever. And if you have not seen the SNL skit on Squid Game and their rap video, hilarious. Oh, it's kind of a country rap. Definitely go check that out. And based on the company's plans to increase content expenditures, it lowballed earnings per share guidance for the fourth quarter, and that hurt the stock price. Due to Netflix's global reach, it's getting harder to predict earnings due to their foreign exchange volatility. Global streaming paid net additions were up 4.38 million. Well above guidance, helped by, again, more content, as the first halves of the year's releases were held up by COVID delays in 2020. It was a good quarter for Netflix, but it wasn't their best. The stock fell 2.2% after announcing earnings and lower guidance. Tesla, on the other hand, had a great quarter with a 73% increase in deliveries. Gross margins improved up to 30.5% despite a drop of 6% in average selling prices while commodity costs increase, mainly due to ramping up production at its Shanghai factory, which has really helped, with the company's CFO stating that they continue to see higher fixed cost absorption. That profitability could take a hit, though, with new facilities opening up in Austin, Texas, and Germany. Elon Musk commented on the supply chain issues many are seeing, saying he doesn't see an improvement in the near term and sees chip availability still being an issue all the way out to 2023. The company has also mentioned they will continue to see a 50% average annual growth in vehicle deliveries, but stated that their backlog is growing and average customer wait times are getting longer. Tesla's stock was up 3.3% after earnings, so great reaction there. There were some negatives this week. IBM, Big Blue, finished down 9.6% after earnings, after it missed revenue estimates on a flat year-over-year comparison. Intel was down 11.7% due to disappointing margin guidance, and Snap fell 26.6% after the company missed earnings and guided fourth quarter revenues below consensus. Snap had a reverberating effect on other companies Friday, with Google down 2.9%, Facebook down 5.1%, and Amazon down 2.9%. A lot of the disappointment for Snap came from the rollover of Apple's app tracking transparency changes that allows iPhone users to opt out of tracking by advertisers which makes it difficult for those advertisers to gain insight from their ad campaigns. Snap underestimated the impact this would have when they had previously increased their guidance on earnings for the third quarter. They had beat earnings by 9 cents, but the revenue growth far underachieved at $1.07 billion versus lower guidance of $1.16 billion. Even with a growth of 57.3% over the year prior, which is amazing, investors slammed the stock, again down 26.6% after earnings. That's it for this week's wrap-up report, with the Dow closing at new highs on Friday despite Intel's earnings reaction, and the S&P 500 reaching that goal Thursday on another overall week of stronger earnings results. Gold broke above $1,800 an ounce at one point on Friday, but was talked down by comments from Fed Chair Powell that the Fed is on track to reduce its asset purchase program to finish by mid-2022, with a base case scenario for supply bottlenecks to be resolved and for inflation to push back to 2% by the end of 2022. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the Technician this week.
At this point, given the current weather patterns that are in place, how much of a risk is there of a colder than average winter?
Well, unfortunately, despite the prayers, at least in North America, it is significantly higher. We are developing another La Nina. This is not always the most common thing of having a La Nina follow a previous La Nina. We saw this a lot in the 70s until 82. We had two La Ninas and then four El Ninos and then two La Ninas again over the course of a 10 or 11 year period. And this often occurs when we're seeing more movement in the Pacific for long-term impact. Short-term, though, we are looking at a moderate La Nina that has been developing and looks like it's going to become a full-fledged La Nina around midwinter.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939. Or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, after a brief pullback at the beginning of the month, stocks are maintaining another positive week. Will this continue? Where do we go from here? Joining us on the program is Gina Martin Adams. She's chief equity strategist at Bloomberg. And Gina, in your latest piece, some stumble but no crumble. Let's talk about that for the S&P.
Yeah, I think, Jim, it's pretty indicative of our general view, which is still pretty constructive on stocks over a longer term, but expecting, you know, the near-term volatility to kind of continue. Lots of churn in the market has emerged over the last couple of months. I think that's going to continue to be the case as we start to absorb some pretty significant policy changes coming in coming months and quarters, and a slowdown in earnings growth, but not necessarily a massive slowdown.
So you're basically saying that the S&P could get over 4,600 and the fundamentals are going to carry the day. We are seeing some good earnings reports that are coming out. I think we've had, about 80 companies in the S&P 500. Do you see that trend to continue and margins expanding?
Yeah, very good question. Certainly keys on a topic very near and dear to us with respect to margins. I do think that the earnings stream is going to remain probably considerably more resilient than the buy side community believes. I do think there is some downdraft in sell side estimates that we're going to have to weather, specifically related to the margin concerns. Especially because oil prices have risen as fast as they have. We generally don't escape periods in which oil prices rise this quickly without some distress emerging in stocks. So I think we've got to get through that hurdle. I think sell side expectations are a little bit too robust in the short term and will not need to come down a bit to reflect what is more persistent supply chain struggle and issues than many analysts were anticipating earlier this year. That said, I think the vast majority of investors are still generally pessimistic that we can produce double-digit earnings growth into the year ahead, yet our macroeconomic models say it's absolutely likely that we do continue to produce above-average earnings growth. And that probably powers a relatively constructive view towards stocks continuing to emerge in the actual investor universe.
So you've got two things. We've had an uptick in inflation. We have oil prices on the day you and I are speaking on Thursday. We're at roughly a little over $83. Some believe we could hit 90 and 100. And we also have rising interest rates. So do you think rising rates or oil could have an impact on what we see going forward?
Yeah. I'm more worried about oil right now. I think that interest rates are rising in line with general guidance from the Fed, suggesting they're going to begin the taper, and general anticipation of higher interest rates on the short end emerging in the second half of this year. But the rise in rates that's affiliated with more fear around inflation is probably more damaging, or more potentially damaging, to the equity market. And it's directly related to oil. Oil prices accelerating this fast could have negative impacts on growth. More likely, it has a negative impact on margins in the short run. I mean, when we're talking oil prices up something like 90% year on year, that's a 2 standard deviation move relative to long-term average oil price growth. The 2 standard deviation moves just don't happen that often. They've only happened 4 times in history since the early 1980s. And after each one of those periods in time, we did have a short-term wobble in stocks. On average, stocks fell 10%. Now, what didn't happen is any discernible evidence in the earnings stream emerging to suggest that it was oil prices that directly impact the S&P 500 earnings stream. Instead, it becomes more about companies that have a little bit of difficulty passing along those increases, and potentially oil prices rise so fast that they degrade the outlook for broader economic growth, and then that becomes problematic. I think that it's unlikely that we see oil prices really dampen the outlook for economic growth, because there's so much cash just sitting on the sidelines, and consumer spending on energy as a share of overall spending is still extremely low, even though oil prices are high. So it seems unlikely that we have a massive downdraft in growth. Instead, I think this high oil price is probably going to create some wobbly earnings in the short run, where companies are going to struggle to pass along that price increase. They'll pass it on in bits and pieces, but it's really unlikely that they're going to be able to absorb the entire thing, pass it along, and see margins just move higher in a straight line north. So I think that it's a bit of a nuanced call, where we don't see it, you know, completely creating a big crash or massive disruption, but it does create problems for select stocks, select industries. In particular, the consumer industries are an area of focus for us right now. Retailers typically do see some disruption when oil prices rise this fast.
Let's stay on oil for a minute, because if we look at recessions in the past, Gina, they've been accompanied by rising oil prices and rising interest rates. So, you know, we've got a little bit of both right now.
Right.
But I also have heard some analysts say, look, you know, back in 2014, we had $110 oil and we were doing okay.
Right.
So do you go along with those analysts that are saying that, you know, even if prices rise, we can still handle that?
Yeah, I would say it's more akin to a 2011 than 2014, where we also saw a pretty significant gain in oil price. We saw, you know, at that point, the Fed attempting to backpedal on monetary policy. We were coming, you know, we were a full year out of recession, more than a year out of recession by the time we got to 2011, but still in that early cycle phase in which growth was, you know, had bounced significantly out of recession, but was starting to slow. So there are certainly periods of time. This has been a faster oil price gain on a year-over-year basis than either 2011 or 2014. And so we want to be conscientious of that. But at the same time, we've also had a much faster economic recovery. We've also had much greater fiscal and monetary policy supports that are now deeply embedded in the economy. I think many people would say that that creates vulnerability. I actually think that that has created a degree of stability that we want to respect and want to acknowledge. We see it in the money growth. We see it in liquidity. It is very unlikely that the Fed moves at a rapid pace to remove that liquidity. And so I don't think the economy is particular, is so terribly vulnerable to the oil price gains right now, because we have such a great degree of support deeply embedded from policymakers. They'll start to take it away from us, certainly, as they should. But, I don't think they're going to completely take this punch bowl right away from the party. I think it's just going to be an incremental removal of support. And that should inherently create some degree of stability.
Yeah, one of the things that we've been looking at is the balance sheet and cash positions of consumers with, being locked in. A lot of people built up their savings. There's been, additional checks coming from the government. And you can certainly see this in the consumer discretionary sector of the S&P.
Yeah, and I completely agree. I'm actually writing about this again for next week. One of the things that I think has kind of gotten lost in this conversation about inflation is just how much of it is coming because of a very, very robust demand environment, which is a very different type of inflation, where consumers are flush with cash, looking for some place to spend that cash to a large degree. And that is creating a much different environment than we certainly have experienced in the U.S. than in a long time. If you think about just even in perspective where we are relative to the point we were in 2011, at that point we were coming off of, a massive debt crisis in which households had over-levered to a greater degree than at any point in modern history, where, home prices were crashing, household wealth had been destroyed. We're in a completely polar opposite scenario right now. Cash savings are at all-time highs. Disposable income is growing at an extremely strong pace. We've got very low debt relative to income. Household wealth is growing exponentially. It's just a completely polar opposite scenario to where we were the last time we experienced, a sort of economic recovery. And a lot of that you have to give policymakers credit for. Some of that is just a cleansing of excess that that's been underway for the last decade and change, but certainly the infusion of cash that policymakers sort of bestowed upon the economy is a large part of the story as well.
You know what really surprised me, Gina, during this whole COVID thing is where money has gone. I mean, I'm a sailor. Boat sales, most of the boat dealers are sold out to 2023. If you're looking at RVs, good luck trying to get one or get one serviced. Car dealers, jets, big consumer items have been a hot thing with consumers.
Yeah. And, part of that is also a reflection of where we've been, where demand was not necessarily strong for that for a long period of time, as the consumer was really more focused on paying down debt, cleaning up their balance sheet, sort of right-sizing their leverage positions. And part of it is a reflection of all of this capital. There's been an incredible wealth build in particular, which is obviously the boating industry would be significantly more sensitive to than many other industries. There's also been, an anomalous period in which interest rates are extremely low, which is creating some demand for even levered loans. But I think it's a combination of a lot of factors that have created a much healthier and potentially much more enduring cycle of demand from households, especially in comparison to where we were the last 10 years. I mean, I think that the natural proclivity of the investor base is to say, okay, what's been happening will continue to happen. And actually, I think that cycles happen and they all happen in very different ways. And I firmly believe this cycle is going to look completely different to the cycle that developed following the great financial crisis. Where growth was generally suppressed. Households weren't particularly interested in spending, certainly didn't have the capacity nor the appetite to lever up. Completely alternative view to today.
As you look at this market, the big tech companies, or I call them the Fab Five, have dominated much of the action in the S&P. Do you see that broadening out beyond tech as we're seeing? Well, right now we're seeing financials and energy lead the market, but do you see that broadening out in the future?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, we've had a call in place since September of 2020 suggesting that tech was no longer likely to be the big dominant market leader. And instead, we would see more distribution of returns into traditionally more value-oriented sectors, more inflation-sensitive spaces, more cyclically-oriented industries. Currently, our sector strategy is in favor of financials and energy above all sectors. It disfavors industrials, materials, and some of the consumer names because of the short-term concerns we have over margins impacting those sectors. But tech has been sort of in the middle of the pack for the vast majority of a little more than a year now in our sector scorecard, really reflecting the opportunities that moving beyond big tech. I think one of the reasons why big tech outperformed so much over the course of the last, call it 5 to 7 years, is largely because of a dearth of growth prospects in other sectors. So certainly some of it was because these are dominant providers with superior products and, rapidly expanding market share. But some of it was also the fact that investors were hiding in this space due to a lack of opportunity elsewhere. And I think the natural result of an economy that's going to grow at a much faster pace, a balance sheet that's significantly more repaired on the part of the U.S. households, and generally faster earnings and cash flow growth for companies would suggest that the opportunity set is expanding. And it's moving to sectors that were largely left behind in a period of time in which tech was so dominant.
So as you look at this market going forward, if you had to put money to work right now, financials and energy are leading the S&P, what would you be doing?
Yeah, I think I would be starting to put more into, if you're thinking about doing sector strategy or factor strategy, investing in specific styles in the U.S., I would be leaning more toward value-oriented sectors as the area of greater opportunity where valuations are still low, but all earnings prospects still improving on a relative basis. You know, if you're thinking about an environment where interest rates are increasing, growth is still strong but slowing, but inflation remaining stickier than expected, that seems to be the sweet spot. Now, I do think there are also opportunities around the world outside of the U.S. There is some risk that in a broader portfolio perspective, a more global portfolio perspective, the U.S. may lag the rest of the world in that kind of environment. Recall, one of the characteristics of the last cycle was the U.S. strongly, dominantly outperformed every other major market in the world, again, largely because of tech, but also potentially because of limited growth prospects globally. If global growth this cycle proves to be significantly faster or even just a touch faster, if inflation pressures prove to be a little bit stronger, you would want to structure your portfolio presumably differently. And our global model would point you to opportunities in other developed and emerging markets as better opportunities. You know, if you think inflation, for example, is going to remain very high, oil prices are going to remain very high over the course of the next year or so, you would want to migrate toward Latin America. If you think that, COVID is going to continue to fall quickly and economies reopen, your better opportunities are probably on those economies that are just now starting to reopen, like the Australias and the Japans of the world. Canada has historically been a pretty good location for investment prospects where inflation is high as well. So I do think that there are opportunities around the world. Valuations certainly suppressed in areas outside of the U.S. relative to the U.S. Would give you better risk reward potential if you do believe that we're going to grow and or we're going to have some stickier than expected inflation.
Well, listen, Gina, I want to thank you for coming on the program. If you are a professional with the Bloomberg Terminal, I'm sure you're aware of Gina's work. But if anybody else wanted to follow you, is there another way that they can keep up with you?
Yeah, anybody can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm Gina Martin Adams on both locations. I do post videos and brief snippets and would certainly welcome anyone wanting to reach out and connect.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for coming on the program. You have a great rest of the year and happy holidays ahead of you.
This week, Jeff Christian joined FS Insider to discuss gold, silver, the wider mining complex, copper, and much, much more. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
We still expect another leg up, much more sharper, but we think that is beyond 2022. And our expectation is that it has to coincide with another recession and another wave of financial crises. Not as big as what we saw in 2007, 2008, not as big as what we saw in 2020, but pretty significant.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Energy prices continue to climb. It's going to be one expensive winter. I don't care if you're looking at natural gas or petroleum. Let's find out where this is going. Joining us on the program is Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus. You know, Dan, about a year ago, around this time last year, you and I were talking about an approaching energy crisis, and here we are everywhere you look, whether it's oil prices, whether it's copper prices, whether it's natural gas prices, things are climbing. Why don't we take our listeners back and tell them a little bit how we got here, because this is surprising a lot of people.
Well, what happened, obviously, is the pandemic, and when the pandemic reached the United States, oil prices dropped down to almost zero. We actually got down in the real world, like $12 a barrel for oil, and gas also dropped a little bit. And as a result, all of the upstream oil and gas companies that go out and drill the wells and produce the oil and gas we need, they just slammed on the brakes on their drilling programs. And I mean, our active rig count was cut by 70%. And so our production's gone down. It has not bounced back to where it was. And then you have, the Wall Street gang decides they don't want to fund anything for exploration and production anymore. And that's globally. So we have got outside of this OPEC Plus group, we probably lost 2.5 to 3 million barrels a day of production. And it just, it's not like turning a valve. We can't bring that on because the natural decline is brought that down. And then what's caused the shortage this year, of course, is, now we're kind of in a post-pandemic world. I live in Texas and everything's pretty much back to normal here. And the supply chain got drained. So it's taken a lot of energy to restore our supply chain of materials and everything. That lack of investment, it will not turn around very quickly. Until probably well into next year before the upstream companies really ramp up their drilling programs again. So I don't think we're going to return to pre-pandemic production in the whole world until we get well to the end of next year, maybe even 2023. And at the same time, we're back on the long-term trend for oil demand. Then what exaggerates this and what's caused the uptick in natural gas prices is there a very cold winter in Europe and Asia last year that drained their natural gas inventories, and they have been unable to refill those inventories heading into this next winter. So you've got natural gas prices in Europe and Asia 5 or 6 times higher than they are in the U.S., and that is creating a big demand spike for exported gas from the U.S., via LNG, liquefied natural gas, in ships going to Europe and Asia. And there's really a bidding war. I call it the mother of all bidding wars for natural gas. And, these commodities are kind of traded on a global market. And as a result, we got really high energy prices. And we went too fast to the green energy stuff. And it's especially evident in Europe, where they shut down a lot of oil, coal, and natural gas fired power plants, and yet they didn't have enough wind power or solar power to offset it. And they're really suffering in Europe right now.
You know, I predict, Dan, what's happening in Europe is coming to the U.S., and I think of my own state of California. Our idiot governor, we are shutting down our second nuclear power plant, which will deprive us of 10% electricity. We already shut down the first one. He just outlawed gas lawnmowers, leaf blowers, and generators. And we've got all these demands. And then they also passed all this green environmental stuff that truck drivers have to have on their rigs. So a lot of independent truck drivers are bypassing California now, which is one reason why you have all these containers sitting on the lot in Long Beach. But they're not thinking this through. If you're going to go green, where's the electricity going to come from? Because now you're adding more devices. If we go to electric lawnmowers, electric leaf blowers, all our electronics, and we go to EVs, where's the electricity going to come from? I don't think they've thought this far.
It sure doesn't look like it. I could tell you in Europe, they haven't thought it through. I don't know. It kills me how they can sit in a room and are there no adults in that room? I mean, if you get all these like-minded people making these political decisions without having industry experts in the room to say, okay, if you do that and you take off these nuclear power plants, that means we got to build 1,000 more windmills, in the next couple months. It just didn't happen. I mean, electricity doesn't just appear magically. It has to be produced. And they're just not thinking it through. I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, the thing that really strikes me is we've got probably four or five sources of electricity. You have coal, you have nat gas, you have nuclear, you have hydro, you have renewables. So we have like five or six sources to provide power. What they're talking about, getting rid of all of this and getting down to one source, which is renewables, which is intermittent and unpredictable.
Yeah, it's impossible. Renewables will not replace the energy produced by hydrocarbons. EIA just put out a new 30-year forecast and said that global demand for energy is going to increase by 50% over the next 30 years to 2050. And during that time period, yes, renewables will gain a bigger share. Now, this includes hydro. So including hydro, renewable energy will go from 15% of global energy today to 25%. So it's a huge increase. And especially then think of the total energy demand will go up 50%. But during the same time, demand for oil will go up 25% from 100 million barrels a day to 125 million barrels a day. Natural gas demand will go up by 30%. And the only hydrocarbon that even has a chance of being declined globally is going to be coal. And I personally think that is wishful thinking by the EIA personally. I frankly don't see where we're going to get 20 to 25 million barrels of oil production per day more anywhere. Of course, 30 years ago, I didn't think we'd go from 50 million barrels a day to 100 million barrels a day either. So, but it's going to take a lot of money thrown at exploration in order to do that. So there's a lot of near-term upside for these commodity prices, I can tell you that.
At what point do we get where politicians start changing and maybe starting thinking this logically? I mean, if you're going to be in our own case of California, and this is, California, New York, you can put them in the same category, but we shut down one nuclear power plant. We lost 10% of our electricity power. We're getting ready to shut down our second plant by 2025. And the irony of this is we're buying excess power from Arizona that has two nuclear power plants. So we're shutting down ours, but we're using the power provided by nuclear plants in Arizona.
Yeah, it's almost like you can't make this stuff up. how do you shut down your existing power sources before you've built the new ones? It just doesn't make any sense. Now, I think what could change this, I truly believe there is going to be a massive uproar in Europe after this winter. They already have gasoline rationing. They're already telling people that they're probably going to have to start rationing electricity. And, maybe shut down, industrial use and stuff like that first. But, I got something the other day in the quote that really got me. It said, for the consumers, when it comes to providing a warm home and, low fuel prices so your family can survive versus supporting the Green New Deal, guess what they're going to do? They're going to be screaming that these energy prices are too high. They're also in Europe, they're saying that the average family is going to spend between 20 and 25% more for their energy over the next 12 months than they did over the previous 12 months.
Well, they're already rioting over there, whether it's the vaccine mandates or it's energy. But these people really have not thought this through. And I mean, California is kind of a harbinger because we've had brownouts. It's one reason we've gone solar. And Dan, next, I'm going to have to add batteries because we operate a financial business and we can't afford to have power shut down for hours because of these policies.
Yeah. You know, and an area that I'm very interested in is anything to do with rechargeable batteries. I think rechargeable batteries is going to be a huge market. And the way I'm looking at it is the metals that go into this. I think we're going to have shortages of copper, nickel, lithium, you name it. There's no way to go to this electrification of the world without a pretty significant advancement in power storage. The problem that you have with wind and solar is they don't run consistently. Therefore, you have to be able to, when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, you got to be able to store that power so that when it's not, you can draw down that backup power. And the other thing is the only way to make any of this stuff works is your backup power has to come from natural gas-fired power plants. And they're super clean. The reason the U.S. is one of the few countries that has met any of their carbon emission goals is because we've shut down so many coal-fired power plants and gone to natural gas. I just can't understand California wanting to shut down nukes, though, because nuclear power is the cleanest of all. It has no carbon emissions. So I don't get that decision at all.
The other thing about nuclear, you talk about the footprint of a nuclear power plant versus a solar farm or a wind farm. I mean, they take almost 10 times the amount of space to produce less energy.
I know. I'll tell people the Green New Deal is not green. It's not green. It's not going to be cheap. But imagine these huge areas covered with windmills or solar panels. And I mean, really big areas. And they have concerns about, you know, what happens when these windmills have to be replaced and they don't know how to get rid of those, you know, big blades that are on these windmills. And then all the materials you're going to need to build this stuff, the amount of surface mining that we're going to have for these metals like copper and nickel, lithium, you name it. I mean, just steel to build this stuff is going to be gigantic. And again, we're talking big, big numbers here. So people just don't understand how much the mining increase is going to increase pollution or whatever. And that's going to takes a lot of diesel. I mean, you don't mine with little electric cars. You mine with big trucks and big bulldozers and big diggers that are run by diesel.
Yeah, just don't see this working out. And unfortunately, when politicians make these decisions, like you said, they don't have people in the industry in the room and say, well, if you shut down the power plant, you're going to lose 10% of your electricity needs. You don't have the solar in place or the winds to replace it. You're going to have power outs. I mean, they need somebody in the industry, but they don't like that because they think, well, if somebody in the industry, they're biased. But as you say, energy transitions take 2 to 3 decades, and these guys are saying they want to get it done in 10. I just don't see that happening.
I don't see it happening. I got a Net Zero article the other day said that this transition to green energy, the actual cost could be $150 trillion. Where the heck is that going to go? You talk about inflation. I mean, we'll be dealing with monopoly money or something.
Let's go to Wall Street for a minute, because I was talking to one of our technicians, and he's basically saying the fund managers don't want to touch energy stocks because of ESG, and investment is drying up in the industry. It's going elsewhere. Everything's going to green, whether it's battery companies, solar, or whatever. No money is going into energy field. So those companies that are well capitalized, your Exxons, your Chevrons, your ConocoPhillips, I mean, they've got the capital, but what about the rest of the industry?
Well, I follow a lot of independents, and I mean large independents like EOG Resources, Pioneer, Continental. These guys are now generating a lot of cash, a lot of cash flow. And yeah, they got some of their production hedged at lower prices, but those, a lot of those really low price hedges going to drop off at the end of the year. And they're generating a lot of free cash flow. So they don't need the bankers anymore. They can fund themselves. And I know you're very interested yourself in, you know, companies that pay high dividends. Several of the companies that I follow, Pioneer One, I think EOG is on that list. Devon, I know, is on that list. And they are going to start paying a base dividend plus a variable dividend based on their free cash flow. And the numbers that I'm running is, you know, 8, 9, 10, 12% dividend yield on these companies based on an $80 a barrel oil world. So, that's where it will pick up. The another thing that people need to understand, of course, the industry, because this down cycle lasted a full year and a half before we got back to anything reasonable on commodity prices, they've lost a lot of people. They've had to idle a lot of equipment. The rigs that drill these big shale horizontal wells are very sophisticated, very expensive drilling rigs. And there really aren't a bunch of them sitting around in parking lots. So ramping up the drilling activity, there's a lot of logistics that are going to have to take place. And so the U.S. is going to have trouble getting back to where it was, much less keeping up with, you know, future increasing demand for oil and gas. But we'll get there. I mean, if the government can just get out of the way for a while, we can solve this problem.
You know, it's amazing because, you know, last year we started buying into the energy sector. Dan, I mean, we were getting dividends of 5 to 7% in some of the majors because mm-hmm. they've been beaten down so much. So you were getting almost 60 to 70% of the return annually from the stock market just in dividends. I thought, you know what? You can't beat this. And look where they are today.
Yeah, right. The one thing you mentioned, you know, investors and fund managers are afraid to get into the industry. I think the first place they'll start dipping their toe and moving money into will be the midstream. If the economy gets back going, there's some tremendous midstream companies that pay 8 or 9% dividend yield. We have a in my newsletter, we have three model portfolios, and one of them is a high yield income portfolio, and we have like 12 companies in there. And the average dividend yield is over 8%. That's the average. There's one that I published a report on yesterday that's over 10%. And I think they're in a position to raise their dividend anytime now. They're generating a lot of free cash flow.
So you're looking at the mid-tiered companies. I've been invested in the majors because of the need for income. But a lot of these companies have been throwing out cash flow. You know, they got disciplined with the way they handled money before. And Wall Street is saying, basically, show us the money. So, you know, either buy back stock or increase dividends. And to me, if you take a look at this market, it's one of the few areas that still remains undervalued.
My top picks for the year, I call them the Sweet 16, and they've been, you know, locked in since the first of the year. As of Friday's close, that group, 16 companies, not what single company is below how fast is like triple the S&P 500 index. Now, single company is down for the year. They're all up a minimum of 50-60%, and they're still trading at a 50-100% discount of my breakup valuation. These companies, they started the year so grossly oversold, but I predict we're going to stay in at least a $70 per barrel oil market. And I think natural gas, I'm assuming 350 as a base number, but we're at like $5 for natural gas right now. So there's a lot of people thinking the new normal is over $4 an MCF for gas. And last winter, we started the winter with gas at about $2. At this point last year, natural gas was $2, and now it's $5. So there's a lot of upside for these companies.
Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work you do at Energy Perspectives, you cover a broad spectrum of the energy field, mid-tiers, and even some of the majors. How could they do so?
Well, Energy Perspectives Group was started out as a networking group of kind of interesting industry people, and it's really expanded. We've got like 300 global members. And you can become a member/subscriber. Just send an email to energyperspectives@gmail.com. That'll go to Sabrina. She handles our member services, and she will give you a promo code for $100 off the first year of membership. Now, the annual membership is $350, but you can get in for $250 for the first year to try us out. And I think you'll be amazed at the quality of some of the companies we follow. And remember, they survived a very long period of low oil prices, and they are really, really making a lot of free cash flow now.
Listen, Dan, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. It's certainly going to be interesting watching what happens to prices over the next 12 to 18 months. Thanks for being on the program.
Geopolitical strategist and consultant Jacob Shapiro explains the big picture view of what's happening in the world today, namely a large-scale restructuring of the current globalized order. Though COVID merely highlighted the vulnerabilities inherent to extremely complex supply chains getting pushed to their limits, this restructuring was already underway with fraying U.S.-China relations, trade wars, and China's own need to reorient their economy away from being so heavily dependent upon exports and more towards domestic consumption. That said, what we are now experiencing is the beginning of a new global order, not the death of globalization per se, but one that places a much higher premium on the sourcing of goods rather than just how cheaply they can be made. What that means, of course, is we may just be more prepared and resilient in the face of another global pandemic, but we'll also be paying a bit more for, well, just about everything.
There were changes happening in global supply chains before COVID-19. You could say it started in 2008. You could say it started with the Trump trade war. That's all basically academic. But there were certain changes that were happening in supply chains, and with globalization sort of running into some very concrete national constraints that were putting pressure on the system already. And the system has been, I would say, sort of pathologically made too efficient. Everything was just in time. There was no space for worrying about a worst case scenario.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Joining us on today's edition of Smart Macro is Chris Poplava, our Chief Investment Officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And today we're going to discuss the big move in interest rates, the commodity sector, where we see multi-decade low inventories on a number of very widely used commodities. So Chris, I've got a chart here and we're going to post these where this interview is located on Financial Sense. Let's start off with this first chart, which is showing a pretty big move up in rates globally.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. You know, one of the things you and I discussed a few weeks back was typically interest rates move up in concert with economic growth. And what I was showing was that when you look at the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index for multiple regions, that Europe, China, the US, UK, pretty much every major region, we're seeing their economic surprise indexes in negative territory. So I was arguing that the rise in interest rates was not due to accelerating global growth, but rather, I felt, due to rising inflation expectations. And we've seen this not just here in the US, but really across the board, a rise in break-even inflation rates. And this has spun over to a rise in, interest rates across the globe, you know, hitting 2+ year highs. So you look at the U.S., our 2-year treasury is approaching 50 basis points. In Germany, they've risen considerably as well, still in negative territory, though. And New Zealand is pushing almost 2% on their 2-year bond yield. And you look at the U.K., they have risen dramatically. As early as July, they were roughly maybe 15 basis points or so, and now they're hitting 66 basis points. So if you think about it from, you know, let's just call it 0 to 66, I mean, that's equivalent to 2 to 2.5 BOE rate hikes. So we're seeing some significant tightening in short-term bond yields, but this is also spilling over into long-term bond yields. The U.S., our 10-year treasury is back above 1.6, also kind of pushing near the highs of the year. In Germany, they're pushing negative 10 basis points. Just to give you an idea, they were roughly around negative 50 basis points just a few months ago. So Germany is seeing a pickup there. The UK, they're over 1% now on their 10-year treasury. They're around 1.15. And in Japan has also seen a little bit of a lift. They're essentially at zero back in August, and they're around 10 basis points on their 10-year. So this is not just U.S., this is global. It's impacting short-term rates, long-term rates, and I think this is going to really kind of keep central banks pushed in terms of hiking as we start to see inflation remaining persistent, not temporary.
So, Chris, as you mentioned earlier, you believe part of the situation that we see with the rise in short and long-term rates and the tightening that this is having on financial markets, that this is in part due to commodity prices. Can you tell us about this next chart that we're looking at? What commodities are included in this basket, and what is this chart telling you about the macro landscape as you see it right now?
You know, you're right, Chris. I do think that the rise in inflation and in terms of interest rates is due to commodities, because when you look at the CRB Raw Industrial Index, and that's the chart that we'll have available for listeners, that hit an all-time high. And this index goes back to the Great Depression. So it has gone absolutely vertical recently. And what's interesting is if you look at some of the commodities like oil and others over the summer that corrected, this index did not, because it's largely a spot index, meaning there's not a futures market for some of these commodities. I mean, it has commodities such as leather, burlap, I mean, a whole host of raw industrials that are used for manufacturing. And this, as I mentioned, has gone completely vertical, hitting a new all-time high. And for me, it's not just a demand issue, and it's not just a supply, it's both. But the really perplexing thing right now is supplies. Usually, you typically see a low in terms of inventories as you get near the end of the cycle and you start to see demand kind of go through inventories, because it does take a while for production to be expanded a couple of years into an economic cycle. However, in this circumstance, we've had just chronic underinvestment in the commodity sector, so that when we had a massive surge in demand for goods, which require raw industrial inputs, the supply was just not there to meet it. And when you look at aluminum is near multi-decade lows. Lead is near multi-decade lows. Copper, even with the price rise that copper's had, it still has not seen a significant rise in inventories. Zinc is relatively close to its decade lows. Cobalt is near a 10-year low. Even tin is near multi-decade lows. And this is really starting to pose a problem. One of the things that's been kind of making the rounds lately is a real shortage in magnesium. Magnesium is used as a hardening agent for aluminum. And in Germany, they're basically predicting that they will be out of their magnesium inventories as soon as next month. So how are you going to manufacture, aluminum that's used in cars and automobiles when you don't have the hardening agent? So the auto industry is really going through a crunch right now, not just semiconductors that go into our automobiles that have more and more acting like computers, but also in terms of shortages for other raw materials like aluminum. One of the companies that could be really hurt here in the U.S. is Ford. Ford is really pushing aluminum in terms of its manufacturing of its trucks to help cut weight and increase fuel efficiency. So we could really see some U.S. auto manufacturers really hurt by the shortage. So it's widespread. It's not just the auto industry. One of our clients, they manufacture evaporative cooling systems, which obviously take aluminum and copper, and they're having a hard time sourcing their aluminum. And orders that they've already placed, they're stuck on ships off of California's coast. So, even ships or orders that they've already placed, they're stuck in logistical log jams off, shipping off the coast of California. And for future production, they're having a hard time securing it. So we're seeing a lot more force majeure being declared by sellers of raw materials because of the widespread global shortages. So for me, I think this will just continue to put pressure on commodity prices, pressure on interest rates, and ultimately pressure on central banks to do something to curb this. So I think that's a growing real risk as we move forward in the next couple of months here, that we might see a hit to global growth based on all these shortages. I mean, it doesn't matter if you have demand for cars. If you don't have any car to sell, you will see a slowdown in sales, retail sales across the board.
Talking about a slowdown, we have seen a rolling over in manufacturing indices for a variety of different places around the globe. The U.S. is still holding up okay, but it would appear that this deceleration or slowdown that we were expected to see into 2022 is being reflected in the data at this point.
That's correct. We have seen a peak in global growth, which you're starting to see some calls by some really well-known strategists like Mike Wilson at Morgan Stanley, Barry Bannister at Stifel Nicolaus, and others calling for a correction, because that's typically what you see. I mean, even the Laxman Akuthan, the head at Economic Cycle Research Institute, they've been making the call for a correction. And the reason for that is corrections typically occur during economic growth slowdown. So these are periods where growth is positive, but it's slowing. If you go back to, you know, last 10 years, this is really what you've seen, is that almost all corrections occur during these growth slowdowns. So we're going through that right now. As I mentioned earlier, economic surprise indices are in negative territory. You look at LEIs for the US, Europe, elsewhere, those have peaked. So the whole world is decelerating, and yet we're seeing, you know, at least here in the US, stock markets near their highs. So, you know, that's one of the things that's confounding strategists, is how stocks were remaining supported while the fundamentals would argue, you know, more of a sinister background for stocks. You know, it's hard for stocks to rally when inflation is accelerating, when economic growth is decelerating, and at the same time with this high inflation pressure, there is a risk that central banks will have to be more hawkish than they otherwise would want to.
Now, before we discuss these energy charts, can you tell us a little bit about building on comments when we spoke with you last? Because I believe you said at this point, Financial Sense Wealth Management is basically neutral on the stock market, but we're overweight energy. And as we have been discussing, we were expecting a 2022 slowdown. So that is underway, which would account for having a bit more of a cash buffer in place currently. Can you describe to our listeners where we're at and how we're approaching the market as it currently stands?
You're correct. One of our biggest sector overweights is the energy sector. And it's mainly because we are very much concerned about an energy crisis this winter. You know, we're going into winter. I mean, you've already heard the massive spike in natural gas prices all over the world, in the UK, Asia, and in Europe. And we're not really even in the heart of winter. You know, when you look at the US, we're seeing also relatively low inventories of key energy commodities. For example, gasoline inventories here in the U.S. are at their five-year lows. I mean, we're literally right there on the line, hugging our five-year lows for inventories. When you look at oil, we're almost at our five-year low. So we're well below average, you know, pretty much hugging the line for our seasonal low for this time of the year over the last 5 years. And when you look at heating oil here in the U.S., we are below, well below our five-year extreme of inventories for the last 5 years. So we're setting a new low over the last 5 years for heating oil. So again, if we have a mild or cold winter, it's going to be pretty tough. You're going to see a spike in energy bills for the average consumer. This could be hitting pocketbooks and impact retail sales. So for us, you know, being overweight energy is a little bit of a hedge against this. But this does, I think, put more pressure on the overall stock market, which is why at this point we're neutral. And part of the reason why we're not more defensive is I think there's other factors at play that are keeping this market afloat. And to me, that's just looking at fund flows. When you look at U.S. corporations, the S&P 500, I believe this year they're on track to annualize over $1 trillion in corporate buybacks, which is unbelievable, that setting a new record, even beating 2018. So this is keeping stocks afloat with a pretty big bid coming from corporations themselves, and then also even from the retail crowd. When you look at, this is data from Goldman Sachs, when you look at global equities, they are pushing almost $1 trillion of inflows over the last 51 weeks. Now, this is massive. To give you an idea of how big this is the biggest market increase over a one-year time frame. The prior best rolling 51-week period for inflows was $250 billion. So we are four times the highest level in terms of yearly inflows into stocks. So there's still a tremendous amount of money bidding the market up. And to point this out, or the key point, is a lot of this money, the buybacks are, you know, obviously being led by the tech giants. Microsoft alone announced a $60 billion buyback alone. So a lot of this is in the tech giants. These are the biggest weights in the market. And then on the retail side, they're mostly going into indices. So they're not buying individual stocks. And again, the tech giants are the biggest weight in the index. So whenever a dollar goes into the index, they're going to get the lion's share of that. So again, it's why I think you're seeing a pretty strong move in technology overall, which is obviously keeping the indices near their highs. So I think we're going to see this probably play out well through November, possibly into a good portion of December. Typically, Historically, at least, November and December are their two best back-to-back months for corporate buybacks. So I think we're going to see a lot of money coming in from corporations closing out the year in terms of their authorizations. Right now, we are in earnings season, so I believe the first week of November, we're going to start to see companies exit their blackout period. And I think with that, we're going to see a pretty significant pickup in demand for stocks. Goldman is estimating that we're going to see $18 billion worth of equity demand every day of the following week. And then this will get even greater as we get into November. And while I do think near term, flows are very strong, especially we've got, you know, strong seasonal flows for stock buybacks. But, you know, I do think we have more and more growing headwinds as we approach 2022. So I wouldn't be surprised for us to start to lighten up and take some money off the table as we go into next year for our clients.
Well, Chris, as always, keep up the great work. And I want to thank you for coming on and giving our listeners an update on what we're doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management and how we're approaching the market. I want to point out that you have been steadily explaining on our show and the videos we produce every week for a long time now on how inflation is likely to be much more persistent than the consensus expects, and that's obviously what we're seeing today. Along those lines, I want to encourage all of you to tune in not only to our weekday premium podcast, FS Insider, where we get into depth on many of these issues, but also to catch us for next week's Big Picture Inflation Nation. Perhaps this won't be a surprise to many of you, but we're going to discuss how a lot of the inflationary forces at work are being directly driven by fiscal, monetary, and regulatory policies. Unfortunately, many of which are intentional. Once you know the policies and how they flow through to the economy and the markets, the better you can invest. As always, if you'd like to speak with any of our advisors and wealth managers, give us a call at 888-486-3939, or you can visit us at financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. On behalf of Financial Sense Wealth Management, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.